I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Monday, July 26, 57 degrees here in Old Town. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Wasatch County Health Director Jonelle Fitzgerald. She'll be talking more about the COVID spikes and the effort to get children vaccinated before school starts. Then Heidi Goathart with UDOT. She'll be telling us more about UDOT's active transportation plans on state routes and how you can contribute to that. Finally, the executive director of the Park City Extreme Soccer Club, Shelley Gilwald, along with tournament director Carl Lucero, will have details about the upcoming tournament on Thursday. And looks like we've got now Cesar Cornejo from the ABC Forecast Center on the line. Good morning, Cesar.
Good morning, Leslie. Yes, so far today, we still expect to see plenty of smoke hanging around. That's one thing that we continue to see as westerly winds still bring in that wildfire smoke from the west. We expect to see also warmer temperatures. We'll see a high of 89 today and even a low of 62 as we continue to see the possibility of some very isolated thunderstorms in our forecast. Going into Tuesday, we begin to see a bit more widespread storm activity once that monsoonal moisture starts to take place. Once again, with a southerly flow, we'll see a high of 83. And as we go into Tuesday night, we expect to see that the thunderstorm activity starts to wane out by the evening hours, leaving us with partly cloudy skies and a low of 61. Wednesday, we continue to see mostly sunny skies, but then again, storm chances appear for us during the afternoon hours with a high of 82, which means we then start to see them die out once again by the evening time frame for Wednesday night with mostly cloudy skies after that and having a low of 60. For Thursday, we expect to see, once again, just like clockwork, that mostly sunny sky to start off the day and then thunderstorm activity bringing itself around over towards the afternoon and evening time frame. We continue to see shower chances hanging around for us a little bit later into the evening on Thursday night with a low of 60. Friday, we expect to see on and off showers throughout the day and then becoming thunderstorms towards the afternoon hours. Once we start to warm up a bit, we'll see a high of 79 for us. And into Friday night, thunderstorms continue until about almost the overnight hours and then slowly start to taper out with mostly cloudy skies and a low of 58. Saturday, once again, we're in monsoon season. We expect to see partly cloudy skies. Thunderstorms are going to be likely for us and we'll see a high of 78. And going into Saturday night, once the storms start to finally die down, as we go into the overnight hours, we'll see mostly cloudy skies with a low of 57. Sunday, again, we love to see the rain, just hopefully not too much all at once. With thunderstorms likely that day and mostly cloudy skies, we'll see a high of 76. From the Pinpoint Weather Center, I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Over to you, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:11. Good morning. Well, the historic Park City Alliance narrowly voted against supporting a city hall proposal to raise the parking rates at the popular China Bridge parking garage. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on that.
Last week's historic Park City Alliance vote was a close one. 6-5 against support for raising the parking rates at China Bridge to $10 an hour with a daily maximum rate of $40. Currently, rates are $5 an hour with a daily maximum of $18. Parking on the weekends in Old Town routinely fills up by 10 a.m., causing frustration for many visitors looking to check out Main Street. The city does have parking agreements with Park City High School and Deer Valley and offers a free bus from those locations to the Old Town Transit Center on Sweet Alley, but people still flock to China Bridge and Old Town. Councilor Steve Joyce said at the July 2nd council meeting, the city wants to incentivize people to park for only a few hours at a time and then leave or utilize the satellite lots. He said a higher daily maximum would help encourage that.
Part of what we're looking for is turnover. I show up for 2 hours, then Ann shows up for 2 hours, then Andy shows up for 3 hours and whatever. If you just park for the day, that $18 max says stay as long as you want, whatever.
HPCA Executive Director Ginger Wicks told KPCW the Old Town parking situation is a complicated one for HPCA members. She said although a slim majority voted against raising the rates, the organization will be looking toward how effective other city measures are, like increased signage, before looking at the issue again.
While it was very close, the majority did vote that they did not want to see the rates increased. I will say, however, the city in the last council meeting is going to be implementing a lot of different things, cane security, additional police, adjusting signage. And so we'll continue to monitor how those affect the situation. And I guess if need be, we'll still consider raising rates. But at this point, the HPCA does not support raising the rates.
Although the HPCA voted against raising the parking rates, it can only send a recommendation to the city. The final decision on parking rests on the shoulders of the Park City Council. Their next meeting is scheduled for August 19th. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
8:14 now. Good morning. Well, Park City Fire District Chief Paul Hewitt passed away Friday from injuries he suffered in an accident during a family vacation. He was 58 years old, according to a statement from the fire district. Hewitt passed away at a hospital in Eugene, Oregon, Friday afternoon. He was being treated there for injuries that he suffered on Monday in an off-road vehicle accident while on vacation with his family. The fire district announced on Thursday that Chief Hewitt was in critical condition before announcing his passing Friday afternoon. Prior to joining the Park City Fire District in February of 2011, Chief Hewitt was with the Salt Lake City Fire Department for 20 years. The fire district released a statement late Friday saying that Hewitt, quote, served with great dedication. He set an example of true leadership and touched so many with his genuine personality and compassion for others. He will be greatly missed by the Park City Fire Department. In addition to his duties as fire chief, Hewitt was also a member of the Park City Rotary Club, where he participated in several activities that served the community. He was always very responsive to the community. In fact, the first person to call into the KPCW studios the morning of March 18th, 2020, when a 5.7 magnitude earthquake hit Salt Lake City and the shaking was felt in the Park City and Summit County area. He was also an avid runner and took physical fitness very seriously, not only for himself, but for his staff, emphasizing physical health for first responders. The fire district is asking that the public keep Chief Hewitt's family in their thoughts and respect the family's privacy during this difficult time. We'll report on memorial service plans for Hewitt when those details become available. Well, as we have been reporting, the number of COVID-19 cases continue to rise. In Wasatch County, we're seeing some of the highest numbers yet. On the phone with details is Wasatch County Health Department Director Jonelle Fitzgerald. Good morning, Jonelle.
Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, so talk to us a little bit about the state of the pandemic happening in Wasatch County currently.
So we have had an uptick in cases, the same as we're seeing statewide and actually across the nation. We're seeing about 6 to 7 cases per day, which is an increase, about double what we had in June. So definitely an uptick, and similar to what we saw last July, which is concerning. The difference, however, is that we do have a lot of our population vaccinated. If we think about where we are now compared to last July, everybody remembers, you know, we didn't have the community celebrations that are happening now. You know, pretty much we're living like we have in years past, and not worried about the virus with community celebrations, and so it's not surprising that we're seeing the uptick that we are, and thankful for the vaccine that is holding our numbers down significantly.
So are the cases, are you seeing, are they of unvaccinated people, or are some of these so-called breakthrough cases where people have been vaccinated but still testing positive?
Yeah, so by far the majority of cases are among unvaccinated people. We do have some cases that are breakthrough cases of people that have been vaccinated, however. But like I said, the majority by far are among unvaccinated people.
Yeah, can you put numbers on that in terms of the breakthrough cases that you've seen?
I don't have the exact number of breakthrough cases. So when we consider especially our older population, about half of cases are breakthrough cases. Like I said, I don't have the exact numbers right now. But when we see especially of our 80-plus individuals, we're nearing 100% of individuals vaccinated. And so when you say, yeah, when we are seeing some cases of older folks who are vaccinated, getting the virus, it's because of the high number of people vaccinated. So there are very few people that are not vaccinated, and so if there is a case, it's more likely to be a breakthrough case. Okay. I hope I'm saying that in a way that makes sense.
So the numbers I have, nearly 15,000 Wasatch County residents are considered fully vaccinated. So what does that put you at? I mean, are we talking about 80% of the population? Higher than that?
No, actually, 15,000 people fully vaccinated is about 54% of our eligible population. So still only 12 and up can get the vaccine. So that 15,000 is about 54% of our eligible population.
So what, if anything, is the County Health Department doing to encourage more residents to receive the vaccine?
Oh gosh, we're holding clinics on a regular basis. We want everyone to be vaccinated, and definitely trying to make that as easy as possible. People can get vaccine here at the health department, any vaccine that they want immediately. We also have vaccine available at all the pharmacies and doctor's offices in town. So it's definitely not a challenge to be vaccinated because of vaccine being available.
So what is it that you're hearing, from those that could be vaccinated but don't get vaccinated? I mean, what's their reason for saying no?
I don't think that there's one reason. I think there's a variety of reasons out there. There still is, I think, some hesitancy because of the vaccine being as new as it is and possible complications. I also think that especially among the younger population, that coronavirus itself is not making people sick enough that they're not as worried about the getting sick as they are sometimes about the unknown of the vaccine, and I think that vaccine is becoming. We are learning more and more, and more and more people get the vaccine, I think there's less hesitancy, or I hope there's less hesitancy, and hoping that as school gets started again this fall, that we will see 12 years and older, the 12 to 18-year-olds that'll be heading back to school, getting vaccinated. As we go back to school, if somebody's exposed that's 12 to 18 years old, they don't have to quarantine, which makes it, a really good idea to be able to stay in school, continue with extracurricular activities, even if you're exposed, if you've received vaccine.
Yeah, so when you talk about, the concern of possible reactions to the vaccine, I mean, has Wasatch County seen any residents with adverse reactions to the vaccine?
Well, adverse reactions, being just feeling a little bit sick and down, yeah, that's happened. As far as severe reactions, I haven't heard of anything specific. So people do get sick after they get vaccine. As far as the more serious reactions, I have not heard of anyone.
So they feel like fighting off the virus is easier than perhaps the couple days of illness they might feel after the vaccine?
You know, I can't say for sure. I think that it's the unknown of possible reactions, and I'm not really sure what that is. If it's I don't want to be sick for a day or two, or the unknown of long-term complications, which I think there's a lot of myths out there of those possible unknowns, which aren't necessarily true. And I'd encourage everyone to really read up from reputable sources about the vaccine, how they're created. You know, talk to your doctor, learn about the realities of how safe these vaccines are, because there are a lot of misnomers out there about the risks of vaccine that are really unfounded.
Yeah. You know, I saw a news report about what people are hearing is, like, they'll come in for a vaccine, but they want to do it, you know, under the radar. They don't want anybody to know that they received the vaccine. Somehow a mark of shame, I'm not sure, but... there are opportunities then to receive a vaccine in private without anybody knowing about it?
Of course. Yeah, we could definitely do that. I think that, anyone that comes into the health department and receives vaccine, it's not going to be a huge crowd here. And so I think that this is a private environment to receive vaccine, possibly more than at a pharmacy, if that's a concern. And I'm not sure how much that is a concern. If it is, there's definitely a private way to receive vaccine and do that without, you know, other people knowing.
And then, again, as you mentioned, with school coming back, only about a third of the 12 to 18 population that has been vaccinated. What do you expect that to get up to as of, you know, once school starts?
As high as possible. I mean, there's no way to know, but we do hope to vaccinate increasing numbers of those eligible folks. We do have about 35% of our 12 to 18 year olds with at least one dose, which is a good thing. We're actually holding a children's health clinic for uninsured individuals next Thursday, August 5th, from 3 to 7 p.m. here at the Health Department. And we'd like to invite everyone out. Again, K through 12 students can come to that. And we've actually increased the age of that clinic in order to, or in hopes of increasing vaccine rates for the 12 to 18 year olds that are eligible. So that would mean that about, what, sixth or seventh graders on up are eligible for vaccine and can receive vaccine at that clinic, which they can get vaccine any time, but we hope during that clinic to be able to increase our vaccine rates, as well as provide other health exams, dental, vision, hearing exams to kids without insurance.
Okay, so that's, you said Thursday, when and where?
Thursday, August 5th at the Wasatch County Health Department. We have a number of organizations that are participating to help provide health exams for children without insurance. So our Intermountain Heber Valley Hospital, Wasatch Community Foundation is sponsoring this event. And we've got Hope Alliance providing vision care. We've got Wasatch Latino Coalition, People's Health Clinic, as well as us at the Health Department. A couple of local dentists, Dr. Ogilvy and Dr. May, all of these organizations are coming together to offer some free exams and free services to children and youth with no insurance.
All right. We heard from Chris Smoot, the epidemiologist and public information officer for the Wasatch County Health Department, that 33 cases of the Delta variant of the COVID-19 virus have been identified. He believes that real number is much higher. Can you speak to why he says that?
Sure. Well, if we're seeing about 6 to 7 cases per day, and we do know through just sequencing that we're seeing about 80 to 90% of cases throughout Utah really being Delta variant, it stands to reason that most of our cases are. Every test that comes through is not sequenced to find out which variant of the virus it is, and so that's why we're assuming that, and it stands to reason that the majority of cases that come in are the Delta variant, just because that's what's going around.
Okay, and how much more transmissible is the Delta variant?
Yeah, definitely. The Delta variant is more transmissible. We don't know really or aren't seeing people becoming necessarily sicker because of the Delta variant, but we do know that it is more contagious.
Okay, Jonelle, anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
I think I didn't leave a phone number. So if anyone would like to come to our Children's Health Clinic, they can call the health department at 435-657-3307. And to register for the Children's Health Clinic or to get an appointment to get vaccine. And like I said, we can get anybody vaccine, whichever vaccine that person would like, and we can do it pretty much immediately. So vaccines available, and come and get your shot.
Okay. Jonelle Fitzgerald is the director of the Wasatch County Health Department. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Public input process is now underway through August 28th. This will better help the Utah Department of Transportation to develop active transportation plans to provide better access to trails and paths on state routes. On the phone with details on how you can submit your suggestions is UDOT Active Transportation Manager Heidi Goodhart. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning, Leslie.
Did I get that last name right?
Yeah, you did. It's a complicated one.
It might be best to have you tell us just what is active transportation.
Yeah, that's a great intro. So active transportation is very kind of jargony within, you know, our transportation world. It's basically using your body to move from point A to point B. So if you walk, if you use a wheelchair, if you ride a scooter or a bicycle, those are all active transportation kind of modes. And so, you know, being able to walk and bike and access transit and use scooters and get to destinations within your community or to access school and work are really kind of an important but smaller component of our transportation system as a whole. And at UDOT, we really want to understand community needs for more bike lanes, trails, multi-use pathways, crosswalks, pedestrian bridges, and sidewalks across the state. And so we've launched this public input process now through the 28th, like you mentioned, to help us understand where we might need to do more planning, where we might have gaps in our network. If we're going down the right trail, so to say, in building multi-use pathways that are more family-friendly, or we just kind of want to understand kind of the pulse with the communities that we're serving with our transportation system and with our roadways. And so this is really an awesome opportunity to hear from the public about what they want, how we can do better, and how we can build the community of our dreams.
Yeah. So is this a statewide effort, or are you only doing this kind of area by area, district by district?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is a statewide effort. It's very comprehensive. We're going all the way, you know, from like Bluff, Utah, Moab, Utah, all the way up to Logan and along the Wasatch Front. And so, sometimes people don't know which roads belong to UDOT. And so by jumping into our online map, you can easily see which roads are state owned and where you can provide feedback to UDOT. Typically if it's a larger road or it seems like a highway between communities, that's typically an indicator that's a UDOT roadway. And so, we just kind of want to understand what the public needs. And oftentimes, sometimes people are crossing or walking across or driving on our facilities all the time. And they might have different visions for the roadway than what's currently out there. And we want to hear about that.
Yeah. So the ultimate goal is to put together an active transportation master plan for the state, or? Not really.
That's exactly it. So every 4 years, UDOT does a long-range plan, and this is a little bit of a precursor to that planning effort. We want to understand where we might need to give more time and attention in smaller communities or along the Wasatch Front or within our metropolitan areas as part of that planning process. And so this gives us a little bit of a sneak peek to see where we might need to commit some more resources for planning, either on the long range plan level or to put investment into local plans.
So we're only talking state routes here, and that would be State Route 224 from Kimball Junction basically to Brighton, and then State Route 248, which comes from the intersection there of 224 at Kearns Boulevard all the way to Camas. Does UDOT have any plans for these two spaces at this time?
Yeah, so 224, segments of it have multi-use trail and pathway. If you're familiar with Park City, if you're driving down the road and you kind of look to the north, you'll see trail users. You'll see people on their bikes. You'll see people walking and biking with, children, the elderly on e-bikes. And so we do have plans for segments of that roadway. Up to Brighton, we have, shoulders for more seasoned road cyclists to be riding on. And so, we'd love feedback on that. We also have a lot of roadways with trails in the urban areas, like the Legacy Parkway that has a really awesome and very smooth pavement multi-use trail that accesses all of the neighborhoods along that road. We also have Mountain View Corridor. In Saratoga Springs, we have Redwood Road, and that has really awesome trail facilities along it as well. And so, we just kind of want to understand, if we're building them, are we building them in the right way for the community? And then we also want to understand where we should be kind of going back on our existing roadways, not necessarily our new ones, and kind of retrofitting and adding trails or adding bicycle lanes.
Thinking about the bike path there on along 224, known as Deer Valley Drive, between basically the intersection there with the ski resort, Jans and Cole Sport. We've got a bike path along 224 there, built by Park City during certain times of the year, certainly too small. I know Park City has talked about doing another sort of paved pathway just off Deer Valley Drive, but is there room there? We've got a retaining wall on one side and a creek on the other.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I'm intimately familiar with the discussions and the planning and kind of the design quandaries associated with Deer Valley Drive. So yeah, we have the Poison Creek Trail, and then we have a lot of road users. There's a lot of cyclists that choose to go on the road because the trail is so popular. We're having active discussions with UDOT Region 2, which is kind of, our district or our region office, that oversees Park City, and our central design team to figure out, how do we put in sidewalk along Deer Valley Drive, and is that wide enough to be a multi-use pathway as well? If you look in the winter, we have kind of these, we call them desire lines. There's a desire to walk somewhere, and so the grass or the dirt is very trampled down. You can really clearly see that it's a trail, and it has really high use, so much so that it keeps vegetation from growing. So you kind of see these little trails informally all over. And so we see that as a need on Deer Valley Drive. And so, there would be, some extra considerations with the retaining wall, with the creek, with, the existing roadway, and trying to kind of squeeze some things in. But I think that there could be a really cool design with an uphill bike lane and downhill sharrows and a fusion of a sidewalk and a multi-use pathway if we get to the point where we're kind of reexamining Deer Valley Drive.
All right. And there on 248, Park City, I know, working on a path between 224 there at Park Avenue to Bonanza, which needs some help. We've got just it on one side of the highway there. But what about the rest of 248? We've certainly got the rail trail that takes users to Park City Heights on a paved trail, but it basically ends there.
Yeah, so there's discussion with our project team about, you know, improving sidewalk, incorporating trail as part of the 248 project. And, you know, if you have good ideas for what should happen in your community, please leave us, you know, comments on our project website at publicinput.com/u.planning. And, you know, we can quickly respond to surveys within that. You can drop a pin on a map. It's very mobile friendly. We kind of designed it thinking that, you know, most people throughout the day have a cell phone in their hands. And so we've kind of designed that interface. If you're not as savvy with maps and navigating kind of web platforms, you can email us or call us. So the email address is planning@utah.gov. And our project hotline is 385-360-1900.
So are we too late here, just given all of the development that has happened?
No, not at all. There's always opportunity to kind of re-examine the roadway, the cross-section, kind of the width of the roadway. We often have to go in and do maintenance projects, right? We're constantly trying to preserve our pavement. You'll see potholes. We're going in and resurfacing roadways. And so there's really a lot of opportunity to add bike lanes, to narrow lanes, to rethink, even in our existing roadways, how we can move people, not just cars. And so there's a lot of opportunities for, you know, modifying things and kind of changing the status quo, especially on roads that have been there.
All right. And in terms of some other project areas, is whatever happened to the safe crossing for under or over 224 there in the Silver Springs Canyons area? I mean, are right where we've got the elementary school, Parley's Park?
Mm-hmm. I am not as familiar with that specific location, but I can look into that and get back to you and your listeners. I know that sometimes we're holding off on projects because of funding coming together or community support. And so, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of, you know, lining up with a funding source. It's maybe 2 or 3 years in the future, or gathering local matches. And sometimes, you know, we're waiting for the roadway to actually be constructed. Sometimes people don't realize, but there's sewer lines, electricity, lots of utilities under the roadway. And they're put there so that we can kind of maintain access to them over the years and not be, you know, having to move a building or anything. And so sometimes utilities can kind of stall projects just with all of the coordination.
And that's certainly the case, and I believe in this one, because local money I know has been funded, and it's been something we've been talking about probably for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
What about an opportunity then for some kind of transportation corridor, active transportation corridor, between Park City and Wasatch County?
Oh, that's a great idea. You know, it could be kind of parallel to US 40, or it could be, you know, like, you know, kind of a shortcut through a different area. I know that there's lots of topography and mountains. But yeah, you know, there's definitely a need. If people are driving from point A to point B, there could definitely be a desire for active transportation, you know, trails or bike lanes kind of along that further stretch. I've definitely gone all the way over to, I think to Camas, to like drop down into Utah or to Wasatch County. And so, you know, there's definitely a need. There's a lot of recreational biking that happens in Summit County and in Wasatch County. And so, you know, those types of trail facilities, you know, could be built, and we'd love to hear comment on it. We'd love to hear from the community, people that, you know, would like to bike along the US 40 corridor, but it's like too trafficked, or there's too many trucks, and so they don't, or they choose, you know, completely out of direction route. We'd love to hear those comments. And, you know, if it means that we get the counties and UDOT together and kind of discuss alignment potential and actually do some planning work, you know, that's the whole basis behind this. We need to kind of figure out what the community wants, and that's what we're doing. We're asking you.
All right. And I'm assuming that it's cheaper for UDOT to build active transportation routes than it is to build roads. So I'm guessing you have kind of a vested issue and, you know, interest in this issue to build.
Yeah. Absolutely. So in many cases, building trails can be cheaper than us putting in bike lanes along the shoulder of the roadway. And the reason behind this is when we build a bike lane or stripe a bike lane or expand shoulder, we have to build the roadway to meet kind of its use, right? So even though we anticipate bike lanes being on the shoulder, we still have to have gravel and aggregate and road base that would help maintain regular traffic, even though it's kind of in that bike lane area. And so all of those materials cost a lot of money. But when we build active transportation facilities, we can expect, like, you know, smaller vehicles like maintenance trucks and snowplows accessing it. And so the designer can, you know, kind of refine the material base and the aggregate and everything that kind of, you know, builds up that trail, the asphalt or the concrete. And it becomes more cost effective in many cases if we have the right of way at the state or with local government to build, you know, these active transportation facilities. And so, you know, there's a huge safety benefit as well. You know, there's this all ages and all abilities, right? When you think of bike lanes along, you know, like people that are riding in the shoulder on 224, they're often like seasoned cyclists. They have spandex on, very expensive road bikes. But if you look at the trail users right next to it, there's children, there's the elderly, there's like a wider variety of users. And so I think that that's kind of where some of our appeal and directing our attention towards multi-use pathways and trails is, it just helps elevate quality of life for Utahns more so than just adding bike lanes that serve a few people. And so, yeah, there's definitely a return on investment, not even, you know, within the materials that we put in, but I think you see that investment reflected in community health. You see the investment reflected in community happiness and well-being. And so, you know, we really do want to help communities build the communities of their dreams. And I think that active transportation plays a really important part in that.
Okay, and again, for those who are interested in submitting input, again, an interactive map at the website publicinput.com/u.planning, they can have a look at some of the planned and future active transportation projects that you can comment on or, again, identify some of your own. Anything else you'd like to tell us, Heidi?
No, we'd love to hear from you. So please visit our project website or call 385-360-1900 to provide comments over the phone.
Okay. Heidi Goddard is the Active Transportation Manager for UDOT. Thanks for your time, Heidi.
Yeah, thank you so much.
The 18th Annual Park City Extreme Cup, a youth soccer tournament, opens this Thursday running through Saturday. In the studio with details, I have the executive director of the Extreme Cup, Shelley Gilwall. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So this is the 18th year after a cancellation last year?
This will be our 17th event. Okay. But it's 18 years since it started.
Okay. All right. So let's see. How many teams do we have coming?
We have 461 teams. It's a little less than past years. We moved our time slots for each games back a little bit just to allow more time for people to enter and exit the venues, a little more distance and space. So we have a few less teams because we have less game slots.
Okay, and where are they coming from?
Well, 80% of our tournament is traditionally from Utah, along the Wasatch Front. And then from there, we have teams coming from Washington, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, Nevada, and for the first time ever, Texas and New Mexico.
Okay. And they're playing where?
We are on 44 fields at 16 venues, Leslie. So we are all around Park City. We have 9 venues, Park City and Snyderville Basin. We are out in Oakley, South Summit High School, in Francis, a new venue this year. And then we're at 4 venues over in Heber. We partner with the South Summit Soccer Club and also the Heber Valley United to be able to put on the event in those communities.
All right. Well, let's talk about what people need to know then, because what we see are the traffic impacts of kids and families getting in and out of those venues.
We do. The tournament starts Thursday at 8 in the morning. We run Thursday and Friday. Those are our busiest days with pool play at all those venues. And then Saturday, our semifinals and finals. So there's a little less impact on Saturday. We are working with UDOT, you know, the whole I-80 bridge fiasco from a couple weeks ago. They're opening two lanes instead of just one, and they're aware of the tournament. We've worked with Public Works, and traffic will be shut down. They're mitigating some of the things they're doing on 248 by the weekend. So we're trying hard to make sure people are aware of traffic patterns and that we can mitigate as much as we can.
Yeah, and that's certainly one of the complaints to city officials is just the large crowds that come in during these tournaments. We sure. heard it, of course, the complaining about Triple Crown and such. Is this something that you're concerned about seeing in the future? I mean, is it getting the Master Festival license or whatever it is that you need, especially event permit?
You know, we're a little bit unique in that we don't have mass crowds in one place at one time, and people aren't trying to get to the same venue at the same time. I really liken it more similar to, say, a Saturday rec soccer, where people are coming and going throughout the day and not everybody trying to be in the same place. Certainly, we're sensitive to the community's concerns and trying our best to mitigate that. We spread things out. Actually, only a quarter of the tournament actually happens within Park City proper. And so I think there's a misconception a little bit about the impact. We don't do things in Old Town. Now, certainly that's not going to say tourists don't come in, or, you know, the teams don't come in and find activities or go shopping or go dine, because they do. We actually do an annual economic impact survey that, you know, says there's a direct spend of just under $3 million. So we do have a positive impact there, but it's a little bit different than some of the events where everybody gathers at one place and trying to get in and out.
Yeah, and we're talking nearly 9,000 participants between the players, the coaches,
managers, referees, etc. Yes, it is significant.
All right. And in terms of that economic impact, I mean, how beneficial is it besides the $3 million?
To the community. Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you what, it's essential to the Park City Soccer Club. It's the basis for our scholarship program. The club, I'm proud to say, awards somewhere between $65,000 and $75,000 a year in scholarships, need-based scholarships to children from our community. And the tournament is essential to us being able to offer that support.
Okay. So again, they come in Thursday. They're basically done Saturday afternoon?
Yes. Yep. Thursday morning till, well, Saturday evening. All our finals are Saturday afternoon and evening.
Okay. Is there a schedule somewhere that people could see where at least maybe the final games?
Absolutely. The schedule is available on our tournament website, parkcityextremecup.com.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to tell us?
You know, thanks to a couple of our big sponsors, were presented by Jamba Juice. Actually, all the winners in the tournament will get fresh Jambas this year, which is kind of fun for those recipients, as well as New Park Hotel, our headquarters, Utah Olympic Park, and Woodward Park City.
Okay. Also, just wanted to mention too the. In terms of who you take, I mean, it's just not open to everybody, is it?
Well, it's all competitive soccer programs. The ages range from 8 years old to 18 years old. And we work really hard to create good competitive brackets in our tournament. We turn away good 100-plus teams each year. And that's been known to be a late applicant of a, you know, one of the top teams in the state, because they didn't fit in an opening that, say, they would have blown away their competition. And that's not fun for anybody. So we spend a lot of time really thinking about which teams we accept to make sure it's a solid competitive tournament across the board.
We're talking about some pretty high-level soccer, though, yeah?
Yes, we are.
Yeah. And then with the rain in the forecast, any rain plans for that?
Play on. Yeah, you know, the big thing is when we get into electrical storms. Otherwise, we play in the rain.
Okay. So. All right. Okay. Shelley, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Les.
Shelley Gilwald, again, the executive director of the Park City Extreme Cup. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.